You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 19th of July 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up in the programme, not for the first time, the court of Donald Trump recalls a meeting with Russians it forgot about the first time. What did go on at the extra meeting with Vladimir Putin at the G20? Also ahead, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu inadvertently makes some private thoughts public. Saudi Arabia and its allies respond to Qatar's calling of their bluff. And we're also in Helsinki, where unused buildings have become a fertile ground for cultural activities and communal events.
Finland was urbanized like really late. For example, Helsinki grew a lot in the 70s. The suburbs grew back then. So we don't have like this kind of long urban culture. So we don't have any festivals like many other big cities. So we kind of had to create it ourselves.
That's all coming up in the next 60 minutes on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. But first, a quick look at the day's other top stories. The head of France's armed forces has resigned following a contretemps with President Emmanuel Macron over proposed budget cuts. General Pierre de Villiers said that he believed that he could no longer guarantee the durability of the army model that he believed was necessary for France's security. General de Villiers' decampment follows an outburst last week in which he declared that the government should not mess with him on such matters, although he used a different adjective. Uruguay has become the first country in the world to sell marijuana for recreational use legally over the counter. 16 pharmacies began dispensing the produce of state-supervised cannabis plantations today to some of the 5,000 or so people who have signed up to the registry, which will permit them to purchase 10 grams a week, up to 40 grams a month. In order to dissuade legions of tedious hippies with bongos from descending upon the South American state, only Uruguayan citizens and permanent residents are allowed to register. An American senator has demonstrated that elementary nonpartisan decency is not an altogether forgotten tradition. Jeff Flake, a Republican representative from Arizona, has spoken up on behalf of an opponent, Democrat Deirdre Abood, who is seeking her party's nomination to challenger Senator Flake next year. Ms. Abood is both female and Muslim, a combination having a predictably inflammatory effect among Senator Flake's harder-of-thinking constituents. "Hang in there," he tweeted to his rival. "Sorry you have to put up with this." The responses suggest that his appeal is languishing largely unheard. And the small population of Australia's northern hairy-nosed wombat, believed to be down to 250 or so, has been increased by one. The first successful delivery of a wombat joey at Queensland's Richard Underwood Nature Reserve for 5 years. The northern hairy-nosed wombat was believed extinct until the 1930s, when a small number were found alive. The northern hairy-nosed wombat is not, of course, to be confused with the southern hairy-nosed wombat, which lives further south, or with the common wombat, which has a less hairy nose. And welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller. If we are to get through at least 1 week without discovering that we had not learned quite the full story about an interaction between Donald Trump's court and the Kremlin, this is not to be that week. It was known that Trump had conducted a meeting with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, at the other week's G20 summit in Hamburg. It was less appreciated that there had been a second, less formal encounter, as has now been confirmed by the White House, and the reporting of which has been damned by Trump himself as fake news and sick. Joining me in the studio is Mary Dejewski, columnist for The Independent and The Guardian, who has worked as a correspondent in both Moscow and Washington. Mary, is it weird that we've only just found out about this? Because this second meeting wasn't just a few minutes of, well, nice to see you, we must do this again soon. It was an hour long.
Well, it is weird. And on the other hand, it's not weird. I mean, what seems to me most weird is that news of this didn't come out before, because the idea that it was completely hidden is actually totally wrong. I mean, this meeting was held sort of in public, or at least in the presence of all the other leaders of the G20 and their wives, at the formal dinner that was held for them. And what appears to have happened is that Donald Trump decided that he was sort of maybe had better things to do than to sit and talk to the wife of the Japanese Prime Minister, who was seated next door to him. And he moved over and swapped places with his wife, who was seated next door to Putin. And proceeded to carry on a conversation at the dinner table with Putin. Now, you know, this could be observed by everybody else. So why didn't this come out immediately? I mean, there are plenty of sort of willing journalists out there who would have loved that sort of tip-off, but it took nearly 2 weeks later for the fact to come out that Trump had sort of swapped places and gone to talk to Putin and had this conversation, which nobody was close enough to overhear, with Putin. But it was sort of public.
It is strange. And I don't myself know what to think of it. On the one hand, it does seem weird that it is unusual for the presidents of Russia and the United States to have an hour-long conversation. In and of itself, I don't see that that has to be a bad thing. Is it possible that this is getting more attention than it otherwise might have because of the US president involved?
Yes. I mean, I think that's absolutely true. I think if it had been almost any other president, it would have been seen as almost a sort of positive overture of an informal sort, that it was using the circumstances to good effect. But because it was Trump, then something was seen as sort of malign under the surface, and sort of that it was exploiting something without... Now, you have to say that it was outside and against the norms of protocol for two presidents of almost, you know, whatever country, but these particular countries, to have this sort of informal meeting, apparently with the interpreter only for the Russian side. And there's a very, quite a sort of amusing sideline on that. The reason why the interpreter for the American side wasn't alongside Trump was because he'd been given his interpreter for the evening was for Japanese, not for Russian, because he was seated next door to the wife of the Japanese Prime Minister.
There has been a certain amount of attention paid to the presence of this interpreter, as you point out, Putin's interpreter, not Trump's. Why is an interpreter there at all? Putin's English is actually pretty good, isn't it? Some might indeed argue better than Trump's.
Well, you could say that, but I think that Putin himself wouldn't trust his English to that degree. When he first came to office, his English was really very limited. And he's made a very conscious effort over the years that he's been in power to learn English. And so people who knew him, say, 10, 15 years ago, think that he doesn't really know English. But he does know English, but probably not to the degree where he would trust himself to hold that sort of conversation. But of course, you know, going back to the business of protocol and indeed practicality, it is absolute protocol that you should have your interpreter with you for that sort of bilateral conversation, that you shouldn't trust yourself. I don't know whether, say, Merkel and Putin operate without interpreters because they can speak and understand each other's language.
Indeed.
And that's quite a rare thing. But I'm not sure. In this situation, both because of the two leaders involved, because of the qualms on the staff of either side about what they might talk about when they were, as it were, left to their own devices, it rings some alarm bells that there was only Putin's interpreter there.
Sean Spicer, the White House's somewhat hapless press secretary, described the conversation as pleasantries and small talk. I don't have the honour of the acquaintance of Vladimir Putin, but I have to say the idea of him doing pleasantries and small talk is one I struggle with, especially an hour's worth. You can only speculate, unfortunately, about what they discussed. That interpreter is sitting on a scoop to end all scoops at the moment. But is it possible that there is a link between this conversation and the news that has emerged today that Trump is going to end the CIA covert program offering assistance to anti-Assad rebels in Syria?
Because because whether or not that was discussed at this meeting, that is a win for Putin, isn't it?
That is absolutely a win for Putin. I mean, in the longer term, it might actually be regarded also as a win for the Americans, because at some time this probably had to happen. And for it to happen in that sort of framework where he could win diplomatic points from it, that's probably a good move. But I would suspect that this happened at the formal meeting between the pair of them where they decided on this ceasefire in Syria. Which in the south of Syria, as I understand it, and that this ceasefire has largely been holding. Now, it seems to me that this was probably discussed as part of that. You know, it belongs in that category. One of the things that they might possibly have discussed informally may be the prospect of another meeting. Another thing might be the new American ambassador to Moscow, who has suddenly appeared back in the frame today after about 2 months of being sort of absent and on off. We didn't know whether
this
it was
Mr. Huntsman.
John Huntsman, the governor of Utah. We didn't know. He sort of vanished from view, although his name had been in the frame really from when President Trump came in. But he's back there today. And it seems that initially there were qualms in Moscow because he was seen as, you know, not a complete hardliner, but not exactly the sort of ambassador maybe that Putin had as his ideal American ambassador to Moscow.
I suppose we should be grateful that Trump's not trying to nominate one of his sons, but we should look at John Huntsman in some detail, at least in greater detail than the White House did before they issued the statement naming him, in which they managed to spell John wrong, which is quite an accomplishment. He's previously been the ambassador to Singapore and China, former governor of Utah, actually had a pop at the Republican nomination for president. As runes go, is his appointment an especially significant one?
I think it is especially significant one, in part because Trump clearly still sees the relationship with Moscow as key to his presidency. It doesn't seem to me that he's given up on the idea of improving relations with Moscow. So it's key in that respect. I think it's also interesting that Huntsman has two things that maybe will be particularly useful in this post. One of them is his experience in China, because, you know, the Moscow Beijing axis is also of interest to the Americans and to the Western world, and the way that it's being used by Putin as a sort of counterweight to relations with the West, that's very interesting that Huntsman knows China. The other thing is that Huntsman, aside from being a politician, Huntsman's also been quite a successful businessman on the board of such American companies as Ford. And I think that gives him, in a way, a sort of special relationship with Trump that makes him a bit more of a kindred spirit than some of the people that maybe surround him.
Mary Dejewski, thanks as always for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily Live from Studio One at Midori House in London with me, Andrew Muller. Now, all politicians are counselled to treat all microphones as live. Almost all forget this excellent advice from time to time and thereby perpetrate what is known as a gaffe, a journalistic term meaning inadvertent expression of what politician in question actually thinks. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is the latest to perpetrate such a blunder at a meeting of Eastern European leaders in Budapest. He complained about the EU's policies towards Israel, describing the EU's attachment of political conditions to its relationship with Israel as crazy, comma, actually crazy. Daniela Peled, managing editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, joins me now. Daniela, the thing first I always vaguely wonder about such incidents, is there any chance at all Netanyahu knew this mic was live and wanted to actually say all this stuff out loud while making it look like an accident?
Well, I don't think it's very surprising to anyone. It certainly won't have any negative effect at home amongst his electorate and the right wing of his government and the country. And he quite well sums up a very widespread view in Israel, this kind of love-hate relationship towards Europe, whereas Israelis like to think of their country as a European outpost in the Middle East, and like to visit Europe and like to see themselves as part of European culture, and yet feel that Europe is a hotbed of anti-Semitism, the European leaders don't understand them. And actually, when Europe criticizes Israel for issues like human rights, the occupation, Israeli leaders consistently say, you don't understand, this isn't Europe, this is the Middle East.
Is that then his particular issue, that he's just tired of the EU beating up on Israel on human rights grounds?
Well, there's a particular bugbear for Netanyahu. And as I said, it's not an uncommon view in Israel. It's quite a centrist view in Israel that the European Union treats them, like the UN treats Israel unfairly. But certainly, I mean, he was talking to Eastern European leaders. It seems to reflect his idea of, there's a former W. Bush idea of old Europe versus new Europe. So that Eastern Europe is seen as much more friendly towards Israel and much less hidebound by these sort of quaint issues like human rights and democracy and the things which Germany and France are really giving Israel a hard time on.
He mentioned specifically outlined a theory of his that, and I quote, the EU is undermining its security by undermining Israel. Seemed to be suggesting that this double standard, I think, as he would see it, that the EU is holding Israel to, is also bad for the European Union. What did he mean by that?
Well, I mean, on face value, it does seem a little bit bonkers, doesn't it? The idea that Europe's attitude towards Israel is going to have an effect on its own security. But I think what he's getting at, and again, this is not an uncommon and not unmainstream view in Israel, is that Europe is heading for trouble, but with the amount of migration from the Middle East, from Africa, there's a very commonly held view in Israel that there are a lot of Muslims here in Europe, and they're changing the nature of societies, and they're changing the whole nature of the continent. Again, this is not an unusual view to have. I mean, Netanyahu jokes that he's being politically incorrect in his speech, but he could be much, much, much more politically incorrect.
But when he talked about, and again I quote, both Europe's security and Europe's economic future, both these concerns mandate a different policy towards Israel. So I guess in Netanyahu's head, how does he want EU policy towards Israel to change? And more importantly, what difference does he think that would make to the EU's security and prosperity?
Well, the EU is already Israel's biggest trading partner. So things are going quite swimmingly. But annoyingly for Netanyahu, the EU keeps on making these conditions on the occupation, settlements, human rights, et cetera, and keeps on funding left-wing NGOs in Israel. So his view is that if, as he put it in his remarks, if the EU acted like China and India, just working on trade agreements without any political concerns, it will be much better for everybody involved. As for how European security depends on its relations with Israel, I think it comes down to this idea of Israel being a bulwark against Muslim extremism and an outpost of democracy in the Middle East, and that will somehow save Europe. I mean, this is fantasy, but This is coming from Mr. Netanyahu.
Looking at the rest of his outburst, which did veer off into one or two other topics, did we learn anything that we didn't already know or couldn't have guessed when he cheerfully admitted that Israel had been bombing Hezbollah arms convoys in Syria fairly regularly?
No, I mean everyone knew that. He's talked about dozens and dozens. I mean, a few cases have come to light, but dozens of dozens is a useful term. I mean, the idea that Iranian influence on Israel's borders is a hot topic in Israel, clearly, but also for Netanyahu, Iran is his number one issue. And I think he takes every opportunity to highlight that. Whether the attacks are in the dozens or the 50s or 100s, we don't know. And again, he might be a chap prone to exaggeration at times, but it sounds fairly plausible.
He also made a couple of contrasts between the current American administration and the previous American administration. I mean, it was painfully obvious to all who observed that he and Barack Obama got on well, neither politically nor personally. But is his relative preference for Donald Trump likely to be shared by many Israelis?
Well, it's hard to say, really, because on the face of it, Trump seems like a great friend of Israel. He's always talking about his warmth towards the Jewish state and the high-profile visit and so on. And some of his right-wing views seem to coincide with that of Netanyahu and his right-wing government. But at the same time, it's very unpredictable. He seemed to scoff at the idea of a two-state solution, two-state whatever suits, which breaks with decades of American policy. His messaging over the status of Jerusalem is also unclear. His idea that he wants to make the greatest deal of all time between Israel and Palestine is also a little bit discombobulating for Israelis. So he's by no means a simple relationship and by no means a sure thing as far as Israelis are concerned.
Daniela Peled, thanks as always for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Pack your bags and join us on a global tour through exciting and inspiring cities. From Madrid to Miami, Tokyo to Toronto, we've created travel guides that will help you get the best out of a city, no matter how short your stay. We'll whirl you around some of our favorite architectural spots, top cultural haunts, and then point you in the direction of a well-earned drink from a little-known cocktail bar. We've also scouted the prettiest running routes, the most design-savvy shops, and the best hotels to comfortably rest your head. View our full range of travel guides at monocle.com or visit any good bookstore and plan your next escape today. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
You are listening to The Daily on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Now, there are very good reasons why the ultimatum is a tool rarely employed in diplomacy. There's always a risk that the recipient thereof will ignore it. This leaves the issuer of the ultimatum with a choice between two usually unattractive options: to take the drastic action threatened or climb down. It is at this junction that Saudi Arabia and its allies blockading Qatar have arrived, following the obstinate refusal of the besieged emirate to acquiesce to their wishes. Riyadh has now scaled back the 13 original demands to 6 broad principles. Well, joining me now is Lina Khatib, head of Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House here in London. Lina, has this blockade of Qatar, has this backfired on Saudi Arabia somewhat?
Well, not yet. In fact, if you look at the rhetoric that has been propagated by Saudi Arabia and UAE, it is meant to be pressure put on Qatar so that Qatar would compromise. It was never meant to be pressure on Qatar so that Qatar would comply with all the demands that were originally issued. So this is not a matter of Saudi Arabia scaling back. It's a matter of perhaps some degree of progress, between quotation marks, regarding the demands.
Nevertheless, Saudi Arabia did issue this list of demands, 13 of them, and it did impose deadlines by which those demands were to be met on pain of admittedly unspecified consequences. Is this not therefore something of a climb down?
No, not at all. I think from the very beginning, Saudi Arabia knew that it was impossible for Qatar to meet those demands in that specific period of time. And even if they had extended the deadlines, I mean, some of these demands were just not workable in practice. And therefore, everything we are seeing today should not be read as Saudi Arabia softening its stance or changing its mind. In fact, all the back-channel conversations that are taking place between Saudi Arabia, UAE, and kind of the friendly countries to these two, indicate that they feel quite comfortable and they feel that they can wait it out as long as it needs.
So if we look at the six broad principles that we're now down to, what is Saudi Arabia really holding on for here? Is there one key concession that they want to get out of Qatar?
I think the key thing really, which is not a declared kind of concession, is for Qatar to no longer strike out on its own when it comes to foreign policy. Now, I must say, the UAE in particular has publicly, continuously denied that they want Qatari foreign policy to just be in line with their own or Saudi Arabia's foreign policy. But fundamentally, the issue of saying to Qatar, you are no longer to support so-called terrorists and extremists, is meant to say Qatar is not supposed to support the Muslim Brotherhood anymore. This is the heart of the matter. And that means if Qatar basically stops the support, then it will almost automatically have a foreign policy that is much more in line with that of Saudi Arabia and UAE, especially that UAE sees the Muslim Brotherhood as a key political threat.
But is Qatar actually likely to genuinely give up the Muslim Brotherhood just because Saudi Arabia has asked it to? Aren't we more likely to see Qatar releasing some sort of statement that's probably just about going to keep Riyadh happy and then carrying on supporting the Muslim Brotherhood anyway, possibly by less public means?
The thing is, relations between Qatar and the Muslim Brotherhood go a long way back, to the early days of the establishment of the Brotherhood, actually, in Egypt. And therefore, it is very difficult to imagine this relationship to just suddenly end. But what can happen is Qatar trying to influence the direction of the Muslim Brotherhood so that it kind of toes the line set by Saudi Arabia and UAE. It can scale down or even end support for certain, for example, armed groups in Syria that are seen as more of a threat for Saudi and UAE interests in the long run. So there are things that Qatar can do to modify this relationship rather than end it.
So is it likely then that we're heading towards one of those agreements which is sort of fairly bland and non-specific? Everybody can sign up to it. Everybody can claim that they won and nothing really changes.
I wouldn't say nothing really changes, because we have seen, for example, what happened in Bahrain when Saudi Arabia basically intervened at that time militarily in order to influence the political trajectory there, because at that time, Bahrain saw protests against the government, and Saudi Arabia did not want to see regime change in Bahrain because the Bahraini regime is very much in alliance with Saudi Arabia. And so it was willing to intervene directly to put a stop to that. So there we saw a fundamental result that is very concrete. And I think with Qatar, Saudi Arabia and UAE will not be satisfied with just lip service and a kind of fake agreement. I think this time they mean business.
Just finally then, if this isn't a climb down for Riyadh, and if this will not, damage Saudi Arabia's prestige or authority in the Arab world, might it end up being kind of a win for Qatar? Qatar has sort of not been terribly bothered or discombobulated by the blockade. It has refused to buckle at the first application of pressure. Is it possible that Doha emerges from this actually stronger?
I don't think so, because Qatar now is able to circumvent the blockade by, for example, using Iranian airspace and accepting food aid from Iran. And of course, this angers Saudi Arabia even more. Ultimately, Qatar is a small state. Its resources remain relatively limited compared to those of Saudi Arabia, despite Qatar's high GDP. And it cannot afford to be seen as being in the Iranian camp in a Gulf region dominated by mistrust of Iran that is disseminated from Riyadh. And therefore, there is only so much that Qatar can do. But at the same time, Qatar could not just accept, you know, this pressure, because this would have meant loss of sovereignty. In the end, we will see some balance but I don't think we can say that Qatar will eventually be the winner in this one. I think Saudi Arabia remains the most influential actor in the region.
Lina Khatib from Chatham House, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. Now, on The Daily, the tiny but beautiful Balkan state of Montenegro is agog at the beginning today of what is being locally described as the trial of the century. And indeed, in local terms, this does seem a plausible claim. Two opposition politicians, Andrija Mandic and Milan Knezovic, face the beak on terrorism charges linked to an alleged plot orchestrated from Moscow to overthrow Montenegro's government on election day last October. 14 people in total are on the hook, including two Russian nationals. Discussed this earlier today on Midori House with Alastair Bunkle, defence correspondent for Sky News, and Phil Clark from SOAS here in London. Alastair started by explaining how the plot was supposed to work.
Election night, you have a pro-European government and a pro-European president in Montenegro. Russia sees Montenegro in its sphere of influence as it does the remainder of the Balkans.
And Montenegro had not yet joined NATO, of course.
Not quite, but was on the path to doing so and has now officially joined NATO. Outside Parliament in Podgorica, a pro-Russian protest against the incumbent and most likely the successful government in that night's elections. In that, some Serbian plotters mix, dressed as policemen. They go into Parliament and they turn their guns on this pro-Russian crowd and fire upon them, making it look as though the pro-European government forces have fired upon the pro-Russian supporters, thereby dividing the country. In conjunction with that, there was a separate plot. Well, it was obviously aligned, but a separate plot to assassinate the president as well. This was all uncovered at the last minute, and two Russian GRUs, the military intelligence agents, are behind it. A guy called Eduard Shishmakov and Vladimir Popov. They're now in Russia, as you say, they've been tried in absentia. And my reporting uncovered a link that proves their connection both to Moscow and to the Russian military. And so what this trial is going to try and do is prove that Russia was behind this attempted coup.
Just to follow that up, Alastair, it is a fantastically complicated, risky plot which could have had ramifications far beyond Montenegro. Why is Russia so exercised about the prospect of Montenegro joining NATO? Montenegro has a standing military of slightly over 2,000 soldiers. For point of comparison, the Metropolitan Police has 33,000 officers.
Yeah, no, fair point, but I could equally just turn that on its head and say NATO wants Montenegro to be a member regardless of those small figures as well. So if NATO wants Montenegro part of its sphere, likewise Russia. Why does Russia want Montenegro, this tiny country? Partly geography, it's slap bang pretty much in the middle of the Mediterranean, but also there's a port there in Kota Bay, and it's a deep water port. They can bring their ships in there if they had a friendly Montenegrin government, and they can refuel in the middle of the Mediterranean, something that they know they currently don't possess. So if Russian ships outside of the Black Sea want to refuel, the only place they can do it is Syria, which incidentally is an offshoot, is one reason why they want a strategic foothold in Syria. But they wanted Montenegro to remain within their sphere of influence in the way that someone like Serbia as a neighbour does.
Serbia, of course, is unhelpfully landlocked. Phil, is this of a pattern with what we've seen from Russia in Georgia, Ukraine, elsewhere? Are they meddling with a particular strategic purpose in mind? And Alastair points out that, yes, an Adriatic port would be a desirable thing to have. Or are they just meddling because it's what Russia does?
I think certainly that there's a strategic element here. But also I think that there is a sort of desire for grandeur. And Putin likes this sort of performative politics. He likes these grand statements of being able to maintain the sphere of influence, as Alastair says, to be able to project a sense of Russian glory back to the Russian population, and to be able to say, look, you know, we are still a vital global player with power and influence. So I think that's why these sort of frontier states and the continuing Russian meddling, you know, really, really matters in terms of Russian domestic politics. I think what is quite remarkable in this case, though, is the brazenness of the plot in broad daylight in the context of a national election with, you know, some extent of international media covering what was happening in Montenegro. And yet, you know, you have a plot that is so out in the open, but also largely ham-fisted. I mean, the fact that it was sort of dismantled as quickly as it was suggested this wasn't the best orchestrated plot going around. So, you know, some really stunning elements of this case.
Alastair, Russia, of course, is denying everything, but they would have done that had the plot actually worked more or less as planned, wouldn't they? This is just what Russia does.
Yes, of course. I mean, Russia is, although the two Russian agents are being represented in court. And, I mean, incidentally, actually, the trial opened today and quite quickly was postponed until tomorrow because the defence are trying to claim that the prosecutor is in some way discredited. I think Phil just used the two words I'd use. Yeah, brazen, absolutely. But also bear in mind, at the time, October of last year, this was one of the first sort of examples we'd had around that sort of time of Russian foreign policy failure. Because actually at the time, Putin was doing pretty well in places like Syria. And this was not according to plan. I imagine these GRU agents will be pensioned off and live somewhere peacefully in Russia. But they did not perform their task, I think, as they were directed to do so.
Phil, are we likely to see much more of this sort of thing in countries which have not yet joined NATO and which Russia would prefer to think of as part of that sphere of influence? I guess Serbia, Macedonia seem the obvious candidates.
It would at least give pause for thought to the leaders of those countries. And I think that's, again, the symbolic significance of this Montenegrin case is, even though it seems to have been disorganized and broken apart quite quickly, that the fact that it happened at all, I think, showed Russia's intentions. It sent a message to those other frontier states that may be thinking about joining NATO. So I think that's extremely meaningful in that sense.
Just a final thought on this one, Alistair. Is acknowledgement of Russia, this desperation to stop Montenegro joining NATO, and it seems fairly clear that this certainly underpinned their intervention in Georgia, that they didn't want Georgia to join NATO, and it must have been part of what they were thinking about Ukraine, that Russia does still acknowledge that, however sprawling, unwieldy, and occasionally dysfunctional NATO becomes, once somebody is inside NATO, it is hands-off?
Yeah, I think so, because one would not be surprised if, having successfully joined NATO, Montenegro then looks to join the EU. And I think those two memberships can sometimes go hand in hand. Not always, but can sometimes go hand in hand. I say not always. I mean, look at someone like Turkey, for example. But yeah, you are essentially turning yourself politically and ideologically towards the West. And militarily, you're turning your back on Russia. The fact that Russia and Moscow felt able to do this in a European country where if you stand on the shores of Montenegro, you can see Italy in the distance on a clear day, right in the middle of Europe, just shows the confidence they had at the time.
I think the other angle on all of this is perhaps not so Russia-centric, although I think that's obviously unavoidable. But I think this also would have to be seen in the context of Balkans politics, that there's clearly a sort of an independent Serbian component to this Montenegrin case, with Russia's in the background, but some of the suspects who are being prosecuted are Serbian. And I think, again, it shows that the inability of the Serb government to come to terms with the breakup of the former Yugoslavia and what it sees as its increasingly subservient place within sort of wider Balkans politics. I mean, I think that this is a part of the world that obviously exercised everybody in the 1990s, journalists, academics, all the rest of it. You know, a lot of people have taken their eyes off it, but this is a deeply unstable, volatile part of the world with an enormous amount of violence going on. So I think we would also need to see it within that framework.
It was Phil Clark and Alistair Bunkle earlier speaking on Midori House. You can listen to the whole show and indeed any of our others at our website, monocle.com/24. This is The Daily. And it is time for a preview of this week's edition of The Urbanist, Monocle 24's programme about great cities and urban culture. This time the show is about looking at participatory urbanism, asking what are the best ways of engaging citizens to make their cities better. In this preview, we're heading to Finland's capital, Helsinki, a city which has witnessed a boom in urban activism. In the city's rapidly changing landscape, unused and or abandoned buildings have provided much needed spaces for cultural activities and communal events. Monocle's correspondent, Petri Bertsov, met up with an urban activist and an architect to discuss Helsinki's urban renewal and to explore some of the abandoned spaces that have become popular hangouts.
We begin our tour at Konepajan Bruno, where an afternoon yoga class has just started. This large industrial complex is a former construction yard of the Finnish State Railways that fell into disuse more than a decade ago. 2 years ago, the red brick buildings were reinvigorated by a group of urban activists and has developed into a vibrant communal hangout. It organizes everything from flea markets to concerts, yoga, cinema and art labs. The locals loved the place so much that last year when it was announced that the German home improvement chain Bauhaus would take over the property, they rose up in large numbers and convinced the city to block the contract. As the 100 or so sweaty yogi gather their mats and water bottles and make a beeline for the in-house coffee vendor, I meet up with Jakob Blomberg, the guy behind the movement to save the Konepaja area and one of Helsinki's foremost urban activists.
Urban activism is really common in Helsinki nowadays. It started to bloom 2011. We have some really nice examples like Somba Sauna, which is this do-it-yourself sauna where everyone can go for free. We have also like Kaapelitehdas, which is like this cable factory, it used to be for building cables. It's a kind of culture center. Well, it's more made by the city.
What attitude does the Helsinki city have towards this kind of activity? Are they supportive of it, or are there kind of a lot of bureaucratic rules and they try to kick people out when they take over a new space?
Well, the attitude has changed quite a lot. I've been doing this stuff since 2011. In the beginning, it was quite hard. So the city was kind of against it because it was seen as some like more work. And also they were kind of afraid what will happen when we give the power to the people, so to say. But then everything went fine and everyone loved it. The city realized that actually this makes sense. It's really cheap. It brings social well-being. It's actually promoting the city. I have also made some cooperation with the city marketing department. And now this year, the city of Helsinki has like this project called Street Art Summer. And I mean, like in 2008, we still had zero tolerance towards street art, so it has really changed a lot.
Do you think there's some elements in the Finnish society and the Finnish social model that make those kinds of things easier? That, you know, the restaurant day, that people just invite strangers to their homes and open up their saunas or just do stuff together. We are still quite an equal society. The income differences are not that big if you compare it to many other European cities. Do you think that has something to, and a homogenous society also?
Yeah, definitely. And of course, we have this long tradition of doing together. I mean, we have this talkot, like in the countryside, people got together to do things together and for no payment. I think this is kind of the same thing, just like in a new environment, in a new way. Finland was urbanized like really late. For example, Helsinki grew a lot in the 70s. The suburbs grew back then. So we don't have like this kind of long urban culture. So we don't have any festivals like many other big cities. So we kind of had to create it ourselves. People were kind of, they had enough of not talking to anyone, not allowed to do anything. When social media really like made a breakthrough, it also like made this possible. And in Finland, people are like really using it a lot. It has been always like that with technology, with Nokia and everything. So we kind of took these tools and started to make this new village again in this big city.
I leave Jaakko and head over to the Nosturi area to enjoy some Finnish hip-hop. Nosturi gets its name from the large construction crane located next to this former naval yard storage depot. It's now an active concert venue, and the adjacent abandoned naval yard buildings house everything from design shops to ethnic restaurants and craft beer brewhouses. I enjoy some delicious Iraqi street food and a music performance by a group of Iraqi and Syrian refugees before heading out to the other side of the harbor to yet another abandoned warehouse. It is here in the L3 Makasiini that hosts a trendy-looking crew of young creatives and that has hosted events such as the Helsinki Design Week that I meet the architect and designer Hella Henberg. It is fair to say that she knows more about regenerating abandoned buildings than anyone else in Helsinki. In fact, her company, that goes by the name of Urban Dream Management, does just that.
In the Helsinki metropolitan area, there's a lot of empty office spaces and office buildings. There's more than 1 million square meters of empty office space if you count Helsinki, Espoo and Vantaa, the neighboring cities together. And that's one of the big problems. Maybe those spaces are not the ones that are the most attractive to kind of creative people and so on. But I think there could be demand of workspaces, of startup businesses and artists and so on these spaces. But then there have been a lot of discussion about former industrial spaces or former hospitals. And I think the situation has improved a little bit in the recent years. For example, the old mental hospital in Lapinlahti, Helsinki, after years of debate, it was opened up to different groups who rent it as workspaces or other kinds of kind of well-being services and so on.
Could you talk to me a little bit about what your organization, the organization that you work for, what you guys do?
So my company is called Urban Dream Management, and we work with projects that deal with the change in urban spaces and buildings in a way that should be sustainable and participatory. And we work a lot with regeneration of empty buildings or regeneration of urban areas in a participatory way. And often our role is a kind of an intermediary between various kinds of stakeholders. For example, we work between the public sector, private real estate owners and citizens or other kinds of groups who are involved. There's been development in the policy making in Helsinki, in the city administration. I think there's been a lot of effort of making bureaucratic processes easier and more human-centered. For example, certain kinds of permits or various kinds of applications processes have been made easier. And there have been programs such as Design-Driven City, which contributed to building public services in a more human-centered way and so on.
For Monocle in Helsinki, I'm Petri Burtsov.
And you can hear the complete episode of The Urbanist tomorrow evening at 1900 London time. And you can, of course, catch up with that one anytime you like after that on our website. You are listening to The Daily.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
Time now on The Daily to take a look at the Asian newspapers. We are joined once again by John Hemmings, Director of the Asia Studies Centre at the Henry Jackson Society. John, first of all, to the Bangkok Post. This was a story that took me aback somewhat, and this is it's about Singapore lagging behind in what is known as fintech, which is financial technology. Singapore, I think most people would have assumed, certainly I did, is very much the kind of country that lags ahead in such realms. How has this happened?
So, yeah, I mean, this is quite fascinating. So fintech definitely has this... It's the leading edge of financial technology. It's the entrepreneurial stuff. It's the new, you know, PayPal at one time was fintech. So this report basically from Ernst & Young essentially argues that they've been kind of putting money into a, you know, entrepreneurial center that will grow these companies, but that it hasn't happened yet. So actually the report is quite positive. It says that, you know, actually Singapore is going to rise 23%. In terms of actual consumers who operate their financial details online, there's going to be, you know, a real growth. But the problem is at the moment that this is the year that Singapore is working on science and technology. This is their big push, if you will. You had recently in London on Independence Day, Singapore had a number of British, including the science minister, speaking about Singapore as this global hub for the future. So I think this article has, you know, it's tossing back a little bit of the problems that they're dealing with in trying to achieve these things. But then also, I think it doesn't end on a completely pessimistic note. It is noting that they are putting a lot of money into it. You know, the Singaporeans are incredible when it comes to stuff like this. We saw with the Sovereign Wealth Fund that when they really put their minds to something, they can really...
Indeed so, but the numbers did surprise me. It says fintech adoption among digitally active consumers was 23% this year from 15% in 2015. So it is accelerating. But
it's quite low.
But it is, average among 20 other markets surveyed was 33%. You really wouldn't expect to find Singapore
trailing?
I wonder if it, I mean, this could be, you know, Japan is a country that is traditionally a bit skeptical of financial implements online.
I have every sympathy. I have massive Luddite tendencies myself. I didn't own a mobile phone till about 2007.
I wonder if that's it. It's a total cop-out, but I wonder if there is a sense to which people prefer cash rather than credit, or also, you know, online payment systems. That could be.
Okay, well, let's move along to the Global Times, my favourite and yours.
Your favourite. Well, I always bring one for you.
This editorial by Zhu Li, who is from the Department of International Strategy at the Institute of World Economics and Politics under the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. A man, he must have a business card like one of those charity checks.
That
they give you. Exactly. This isn't quite as boring as Global Times editorials usually are. It is illustrated by a very nice picture of a panda sitting on top of a bull for some reason. Pointing at a sunset. It's about the Philippines and China.
Yes. So, you know, the big massive story of last year was Duterte, the Philippine president, kind of doing a bandwagoning towards, you know, China, the rising power. They had previously, you know, we've just passed over the anniversary of the Philippines taking China to court, the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague, and technically winning that case, but only technically, because the Chinese just completely ignored it. And then what a turnaround that's been. And so this piece is really kind of interesting. It's got that geopolitical flavor that we like to see at the top end of things, where the writer, you know, says that he, you know, previous president of Philippines, Benigno Aquinas, pursued pro-U.S. anti-China policy, even though it was not conducive to the maximization of national interest.
The thing that I thought was interesting, we're accustomed to talking about Rodrigo Duterte and indeed seeing him as this kind of very sort of angry, belligerent, impulsive, emotional creature. But they're arguing that on a foreign policy angle, at least, he's entirely the opposite. As it says, relies not on emotion-based foreign policy, but strategy that has been carefully weighed. His thinking is keep an appropriate distance from the U.S. in military cooperation, but don't give up on the alliance, develop closer ties with Japan, and make tensions in the South China Sea controllable. This is a bit of a fan letter, isn't it?
It's interesting. I mean, here you have the Philippines, their largest investor is Japan. Their largest military partner is the United States. So maybe Duterte's push, and this article seems to suggest, that their largest political partner and diplomatic partner will be China. So you'll have this balance. And the Chinese writer, to give him credit, you know, seems to be a fan of this idea that there will be balance in the force, so to speak. Having said that, there's a lot of things that, you know, there's a kind of parochial view that if you just do what we say, it will be in your interest. And if he doesn't say anything negative about the South China Sea, and of course, if you know the background, as we've often discussed on this show, China's claiming large tracts of other people's territory.
Well, indeed. Just finally on this, before we move on, the panda on the bull, have we figured that out?
I hope the bull's not supposed to be the Philippines, because otherwise that is a bit weird.
Because
like, ride off into the sunset together.
It suggests that the Philippines is the more powerful beast of burden, ferrying this bone-idle, self-indulgent, bamboo-chewing layabout on its back towards, I don't know.
Towards a paradise, of socialist paradise, maybe.
I'm not sure the cartoonist has thought that one all the way through. We should turn finally to the Jakarta Post.
This is interesting.
It is interesting. It's the latest development in a story we have talked about, which is Indonesia's struggles with an increasingly vociferous Islamist tendency.
Yes. So, but it's a complex story because while we had the Jakarta mayor Ahok being put into jail for 2 years for blasphemy by his political opponents, blasphemy against Islam, I should say, you know, on the other hand, you have the government making a kind of arbitrary decree, presidential decree rather than law, to ban a extreme Muslim group, which we have here in Europe, Hizbut Tahrir, and this one is Hizbut Tahrir Indonesia. So their beliefs are kind of Sharia law, caliphate, global caliphate, and, you know, beliefs that tend to view states that are in their way as just illegitimate. So they are banned actually not just in Indonesia, but right across the Middle East and in many Arab countries. I think only three allow them. Egypt, Turkey do not allow them. But what's interesting is that there's two stories here. There's one, a government that has been drifting closer and closer towards Islamic ideology, away from its secular roots. And this is a country, of course, that has many Muslims, many Christians. It's Muslim majority, and it's, in fact, it's the largest Muslim population country. But it has a lot of different groups, Buddhists as well. So the real story is, are we going to see an Indonesia that gets less tolerant of its population?
John Hemmings from the Henry Jackson Society, thank you, as always, for joining us. You are listening to The Daily. Finally tonight, our weekly roundup of world entertainment news. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco looks at the new most streamed song of all time, the rise and rise of Netflix, and why it's been a very good week for Jay-Z.
Ay.
Fonsi!
Despacito by Luis Fonsi and Daddy Yankee is certainly the song of the summer. And the incredible success of the reggaeton song is not showing signs to stop. This week, it's been announced that Despacito is the most streamed song ever, with more than 4.5 billion plays. Sorry by Justin Bieber was pushed to second.
You gotta go and get angry at all of my honesty. You know I try, but I don't do too well with apologies. I hope I don't run out of time, cause someone call a referee. Cause I just need one more shot, have forgiveness.
Although, to be fair on Bieber, he does have a guest vocal in Despacito. The song remains number one in the main charts around the world, such as the American and the British one. The Tourism Board of Puerto Rico, where both the stars were born, are very happy too, as there's been a surge in tourists going to the country, only because of the song.
Despacito, quiero respirar tu cuello despacito. Deja que te diga cosas al oído, para que te acuerdes si no estás conmigo. Despacito, quiero desnudarte a besos despacito.
Still in the world of music, a very happy week for rapper Jay-Z. He scored his 14th number one album in the US with 444. He is the solo artist with the most number one albums in the country, leaving Bruce Springsteen and Barbra Streisand in second place, each with 11 number ones.
I believe in miracles. Took me too long for this song. I don't deserve you. I harass you out in Paris. Please come back to Rome, you make it home. We talked for hours when you were on tour. Please pick up the phone, pick up the phone. I said don't embarrass me instead of be mine. That was my proposal for us to go steady.
With another 5 number ones, Jay-Z could beat the Beatles, which have a groundbreaking 19 number ones. In total, Jay-Z's albums have sold 36.3 million copies in the US. His biggest hit so far was 1998's album Volume 2, Hard Knock Life, with 5.4 million copies.
From standing on the corners bopping, to driving some of the hottest cars New Yorkers ever seen, for dropping some of the hottest verses rappers ever heard.
Also this week, streaming service Netflix announced they reached the 100 million mark in terms of subscribers. And the majority of new subscribers are coming from outside its original market, the United States. After the news, Netflix shares went up 13.54%. The main hits were the new seasons of House of Cards and Orange is the New Black, and also the new and controversial series 13 Reasons Why, which deals with a teenager's suicide.
Hey, it's Hannah. Hannah Baker.
Holy shit.
Settle in, because I'm about to tell you the story of my life. More specifically, why my life ended. And if you're listening to this tape, you're one of the reasons why.
Everyone is just so nice until they drive you to kill yourself. And sooner or later, the truth will come out.
A second season of the series have already been announced. For Monaco, I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
And that is all for today's edition of The Daily. It was produced by Marcus Hippie. The researchers were Paige Reynolds and Maya Hegard. Our studio manager was Antonio Fernandez. The Globalist is here 8 hours from now with Georgina Godwin. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.